Welcome to The Deep Dive, the show where we really try to unravel complex stories from a whole stack of sources, giving you the critical insights you need and hopefully doing it fast.
That's the goal.
Today, we're plunging into a narrative that I think perfectly illustrates how a single company's future can be profoundly reshaped, not just by its own internal strengths, you know?
Right, but by external forces too.
Exactly, by a powerful confluence of external forces and, crucially, a truly monumental proposed deal. We're going deep on Norfolk Southern Corporation, or NSC.
One of North America's premier Class I freight railroads. And when we say Class I, you should really think of the absolute titans of the industry.
The giants.
The giants, yeah. The ones controlling the vast majority of freight movement across the entire continent.
Yeah.
For decades, NSC has been, well, a cornerstone of the U.S. economy.
Right. Operating this immense network that's vital to virtually every supply chain imaginable.
Absolutely. But if you look at their investment profile now, the very way we understand their value, it's been, I'd say, irrevocably altered.
How so? What are the key drivers there?
By three pivotal events, really. First, there's this multi-year operation overhaul they were undertaking, centered around something called Precision Scheduled Railroading, or PSR. We'll get into that.
Okay.
Then, the severe and, frankly, lasting impact of the February 2023 East Palestine, Ohio derailment. That hit them incredibly hard.
A huge story, still echoing.
Absolutely. And most recently, the real game changer. The acquisition proposal from Union Pacific, UP, announced on July 29, 2025.
And here's where the investment story fundamentally shifts, right? It's no longer primarily about Norfolk Southern's standalone ability to, say, improve its own operations.
That's exactly it. Now, the primary drivers of shareholder value for NSC, they're almost entirely tied to the probability and, just as importantly, the timeline of this unprecedented merger actually completing.
Okay. So our mission today is twofold. First, we need to give you that foundational understanding of NSC's intrinsic business as a standalone entity, what it was, what it maybe could have been.
The baseline.
The baseline. And then we're going to dive deep into the overwhelming risks and, of course, the potential rewards of this proposed Union Pacific merger. It's quite a journey.
It really is.
So let's unpack this. How does a long-standing freight giant go from executing its own turnaround strategy to becoming the centerpiece of what could be America's first truly transcontinental railroad?
A massive question.
And maybe more importantly, what does this all mean for you as someone just trying to understand the biggest shifts in our economy, how goods actually move across the country day to day?
It's an absolutely fascinating trajectory. And, you know, to truly grasp the significance of Norfolk Southern's current situation where they find themselves,
right,
we have to start by laying a foundation.
Right, the industry context.
Exactly. Understanding the U.S. freight rail industry itself. This is a massive sector we're talking about, roughly an $80 billion industry annually.
$80 billion, wow.
Yeah, stretching across nearly 140,000 route miles, it is, quite simply, the backbone of our nation's supply chain.
An $80 billion industry, and yet it doesn't feel like one where new players pop up very often, does it? It seems very established.
You're absolutely spot on. This is a mature, highly concentrated oligopoly. That's the key word.
Oligopoly, okay.
And that concentration, just by its very nature, leads to incredibly stable and often highly profitable long-term operations for the companies already in the club.
So who are these Class I players?
When we talk about Class I railroads, we're referring to just six giants. You've got Norfolk Southern and CSX, they dominate the East.
Okay.
Then Union Pacific and BNSF, that's Berkshire Hathaway's railroad, they control the West.
Right.
And then you have Canadian National, CN, and Canadian Pacific, Kansas City, CPKC, operating as the major Canadian transcontinentals, but with really significant U.S. footprints, too.
So just six major players covering almost everything.
Pretty much. These six carriers aren't just big, they're utterly dominant. They account for approximately 69% of the industry's total route mileage and a staggering 94% of its freight revenue.
94% from just six companies.
94%. This structure effectively creates regional duopolies across the country. For a lot of shippers, they often have very limited rail choices, maybe just one or two options.
So what does that incredibly concentrated structure really mean for the economy, for your supply chain, if you're a business relying on rail? It sounds like they have a lot of power.
They do, precisely. This grants them significant pricing power and incredible operational stability. It makes them incredibly resilient businesses, almost recession-proof in some ways, for those already inside this exclusive club.
And this wasn't always the case. How did we get here?
No, it didn't happen overnight. It's the direct result of decades, literally decades, of consolidation. You can trace much of it back to a pivotal piece of legislation, the Staggers Rail Act of 1980.
The Staggers Act, okay.
That fundamentally deregulated the industry.
Yeah.
Before that act, believe it or not, we actually had over 70 Class I carriers.
70? Wow, that's a huge difference.
Huge difference. Today, as we noted, we're down to this handful of titans. And this very structure, this concentration, inherently creates a powerful incentive for transformative mergers and acquisitions, M&A.
Why is that? Why M&A specifically?
Because it becomes the only viable path to achieve truly step change growth. You simply cannot economically build a new competing rail network from scratch today. It's just not feasible.
So you can't build your way to growth. You have to buy it.
Essentially, yes. The 2023 CPKC merger, which created the first single-line network connecting Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. That's a prime example of this dynamic.
Right. That was a huge deal.
Huge deal. And it very clearly set a precedent, I think, for what we're now seeing play out with Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern.
That brings us directly to this idea of the moat around the industry. Why is it so incredibly difficult?
Well, this infrastructure has been meticulously built over more than a century, right? And it's almost entirely privately owned. Think about the sheer scale.
Okay.
The prohibitive capital cost of acquiring all that land today, just the land acquisition alone, is immense. Then navigating the immense regulatory hurdles.
Right, the red tape.
Red tape. And the sheer engineering challenge of building tens of thousands of miles of new tracks, bridges, tunnels across a developed country. It is quite literally, as some analysts say, one of the most formidable barriers to entry of any industry you can imagine.
So it's not just expensive, it's practically unbuildable today.
Exactly. And it's not a build it and forget it situation either. These Class I railroads reinvest, on average, over 18% of their revenue annually back into just maintaining and upgrading their vast infrastructure.
18% of revenue every year. That's an astonishing amount to pour back in. What does that tell us?
It tells us they're playing a very, very long game. This continuous, massive investment ensures the safety and efficiency of their networks, of course. But it also serves as a crucial defensive barrier. It means any potential new entrant wouldn't just need to build a century's worth of infrastructure overnight.
Which is impossible.
Right.
Yeah.
But they also have to commit to an equally massive ongoing capital program just to keep up. It simply isn't economically feasible. It further entrenches the existing players.
Okay, so it's an established, difficult-to-enter market, very stable for those inside. But how does it actually fit into the broader economy? What drives demand?
Rail volumes are a critical indicator, almost a real-time barometer of broader economic activity. They transport approximately 28% of all U.S. freight by ton miles. That's a huge share.
28%.
Significant.
Very. So demand is inherently cyclical. It's deeply linked to things like industrial production, agricultural harvests, energy consumption, especially coal, historically, and consumer spending.
Consumer spending. How does that link?
That largely drives what's called intermodal volumes, the movement of containers. Goods arriving at ports.
Got it. So what's the recent picture? The recent economic data has painted a bit of a mixed picture, frankly. We've seen some persistent weakness in manufacturing. The ISM, manufacturing PMI, a key index, has been hovering below 50, which signals contraction.
Okay.
But that's been contrasted by pretty resilient intermodal demand, which seems largely supported by, you know, still robust consumer spending and port activity.
So with only six major players, they're not really competing head-to-head across the board, are they? They have their regions. So who is the main competition?
Your intuition is spot on there. The primary competition isn't really within the rail oligopoly itself.
No.
It's overwhelmingly the trucking industry.
Rail versus truck, the classic matchup.
Exactly. Now, for long-haul, heavy-density freight, rail offers significant structural advantages. Cost is one, and fuel efficiency is another huge one.
How much more efficient?
Get this. A single train can move one ton of freight over 470 miles on just 1 gallon of fuel.
Wow, 470 miles on a gallon.
Yep, making it roughly four times more fuel efficient than a typical truck. This efficiency also translates into a much smaller environmental footprint. Rail accounts for only about 2.0% of transportation-related greenhouse gas emissions, despite moving such a massive share of freight volume.
That's a compelling advantage. But trucking must have its strengths, too.
Oh, absolutely. We have to acknowledge trucking's undeniable strengths, superior flexibility, definitely speed for shorter distances, and that crucial door-to-door service capability that rail just can't replicate on its own.
Right, the final mile.
The final mile, exactly. So the real battleground for market share between these two modes, where they really clash, is predominantly in the intermodal space.
Okay.
Intermodal tries to combine rail's long-haul efficiency with trucking's crucial first and last mile delivery capabilities. Getting the best of both worlds, essentially.
This all sounds like a pretty good business to be in, stable, profitable, insulated by those huge barriers. But there's always that one giant external factor looming, especially when we talk about mergers and concentrated industries.
Right.
Regulation.
Yeah, absolutely right to highlight that. The Surface Transportation Board, or STB, is the primary federal body providing economic oversight for the U.S. railroad industry.
The STB. Okay.
Now, while the Staggers Act back in 1980 largely deregulated railroad pricing and day-to-day operations, the STB retains critical authority over key areas, things like rate reasonableness, service standards,
and mergers.
And most crucially for our discussion today, mergers and acquisitions. The STB's mandate when reviewing any merger between Class I carriers is to determine if the transaction is consistent with the public interest.
Consistent with the public interest. That sounds broad.
It is. It's a deliberately high and, frankly, somewhat subjective standard. This authority represents the single largest external risk filter for the industry's strategic direction.
Why is that? Because they use it.
Because the STB has demonstrated a very strong aversion to further major consolidation for more than two decades now. This posture, their historical stance, will be absolutely central to the fate of this proposed Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern combination.
So the STB is the ultimate gatekeeper, but this public interest standard, it feels incredibly broad, almost subjective. How exactly do they interpret that when looking at a deal this massive? What are they really concerned about beyond just market share?
That's the billion-dollar question, right? The one that keeps rail executives up at night. The STB defines public interest very broadly. It encompasses the impacts on shippers, think about their rates, service quality, the choices they have.
Okay.
It includes impacts on labor, on the environment, on communities along the rail lines, and on the overall efficiency and competitiveness of the entire national transportation network.
So it's way beyond just antitrust.
Well, much broader than a standard antitrust right. review. It's yeah. not just about market share percentages. It's about the broader societal implications. Could service degrade? Will competition be harmed? What happens to communities?
And this is why their stance is so critical, because they've effectively blocked big deals before.
They have. They've essentially halted major Class I mergers for over two decades. In fact, back in 2001, they actually implemented even stricter rules specifically for major rail mergers.
Stricter rules? Why?
It reflected a deep-seated concern, even back then, about the effects of further concentration in an industry that was already an oligopoly.
Any recent examples of this caution?
Absolutely. Their skepticism was on full display just a few years ago, in 2021. They rejected a key procedural element of voting trust in Canadian National's bid for Kansas City Southern.
Ah, I remember that battle.
Right. That rejection effectively derailed CN's transaction and paved the way for the competing offer from Canadian Pacific, which eventually succeeded under slightly different rules because it was a smaller deal involving a non-U.S. entity initially.
So the history isn't encouraging for UP and NSC.
I'm not particular. This history clearly demonstrates the STB's deep-seated concern about consolidation and sets an incredibly high bar for any future deals between two major U.S. Class I railroads.
Okay, so against that backdrop, let's zoom in on Norfolk Southern itself. Given this highly concentrated industry, where does NSC fit in geographically? What makes its network so important, especially now?
Norfolk Southern's competitive position is really defined by its dense and strategically located rail network, primarily in the eastern United States.
How big is it?
They operate approximately 19,300 route miles across 22 states, plus the District of Columbia. It forms one of the two dominant rail networks east of the Mississippi River, the other being CSX.
19,000 miles, that's significant.
It is, and this isn't just any network. It's arguably an irreplaceable asset. Its key strategic advantage is its expansive reach. It provides direct access to a majority of the nation's population and its industrial base.
So it goes where the people and factories are.
Exactly. It boasts crucial connections to literally every major container port on the Atlantic coast, as well as key ports on the Gulf of Mexico and the Great Lakes. This geographic footprint positions NSC as an essential carrier for a huge swath of the U.S. economy.
What kind of stuff are they moving?
Everything from raw materials and industrial inputs all the way to finished consumer goods.
It sounds like they're moving a little bit of everything then. Can you break down their main business lines? What drives their revenue?
Absolutely. NSC's revenues basically come from three primary commodity groups, and each has its own distinct economic drivers. First, there's merchandise.
Okay.
This is NSC's largest and most diverse segment. It covers a really broad range of industrial and agricultural products.
Like what?
Well, notably, NSC holds a leading position in the automotive sector. They actually originate more finished vehicle traffic and component parts than any other Class I railroad.
Really? More than anyone else.
Yep. Other key markets within merchandise include chemicals, metals, and construction materials, agriculture products. Performance in this whole segment is very closely correlated with the overall health of U.S. industrial production and capital investment cycles.
Okay, so cars, chemicals, construction materials, big industrial stuff. What about finished consumer goods? Where do those fit in?
That brings us to the second major segment, intermodal.
Intermodal,
Right.
the containers.
Exactly. This segment involves transporting those shipping containers and also truck trailers offered on flat cars. This is where NSC competes most directly with the trucking industry.
And how big is their intermodal network?
Norfolk Southern actually boasts the most extensive intermodal network in the eastern U.S. That's a critical advantage.
Why is that so important?
Because it's crucial for moving goods efficiently from those busy Atlantic ports, think New York, New Jersey, Virginia, Savannah, to major inland markets like Chicago, Atlanta, and the Ohio Valley.
So connecting the ports to the heartland.
Precisely. This business is highly sensitive to international trade flows, what's happening at the ports, and of course, consumer spending patterns. It makes intermodal a key indicator for the broader economy.
Makes sense. And the last big category, you mentioned coal earlier.
That would be coal, the third segment. Now, it faces significant long-term, secular headwinds.
Because of natural gas and renewables.
Exactly. The ongoing transition away from coal for electricity generation is undeniable. However, coal still remains a significant source of revenue and, importantly, crucial cash flow for NSC.
What kind of coal are they moving?
Their business here is twofold. They haul thermal coal, primarily to domestic utilities for power generation, and they also move metallurgical coal, or met coal.
Met coal, what's that used for?
That's a key ingredient in steelmaking. They move it to both domestic steel mills and, significantly, to ports for export.
Ah, so export is a factor?
Yes, and the export metallurgical coal market in particular provides a source of demand that is less correlated with those domestic energy trends we talked about. It offers a bit of diversification within the coal segment.
Okay, so they've got this robust, strategically vital network in the East, moving all sorts of essential goods. But what makes Norfolk Southern so uniquely attractive, so essential, specifically in the context of this massive Union Pacific proposal? What's the core strategic value UP is trying to unlock here?
That's where this concept of the last mile becomes absolutely critical.
The last mile. Explain that.
For a Western railroad like Union Pacific, whose network primarily runs west of the Mississippi and terminates at key Midwest gateways like Chicago, St. Louis, Memphis,
Right.
NSC's system represents the essential last-mile connection to the majority of the U.S. population and its vast industrial base concentrated in the east.
So UP gets them access to the East Coast population centers and ports.
Precisely. Think about it. Currently, any freight moving coast to coast has to be interchanged. It has to be handed off between an eastern carrier like NSC or CSX and a western carrier like UP or BNSF.
And that's inefficient.
It adds time, it adds cost, and it adds significant operational complexity. You often have multiple handoffs, potential for delays, things sitting in yards.
Right, friction points.
Exactly. By acquiring NSC, Union Pacific would eliminate this major friction point. It would create a seamless, single-line service connecting the Pacific Coast, the Gulf Coast, and the Atlantic Coast. That could fundamentally alter the competitive landscape for freight across the entire country.
A single railroad from LA to New York, basically.
That's the vision. This potential to unlock a truly national network, rather than simply adding another regional piece to their existing portfolio, is the core strategic rationale behind the merger. And it absolutely helps explain the significant control premium, the high price that UP offered.
So, if this deal actually gets approved and goes through, what does this really mean for how goods move across the country? Are we talking about a complete transformation of logistics?
If approved, it would be a truly monumental shift, no question. It promises to streamline the movement of goods in a way we haven't seen before in the U.S.
Faster.
Cheaper, potentially both. It could make entire supply chains more efficient, more reliable, and it could fundamentally challenge the dominance of long-haul trucking in a way that hasn't really been possible for either railroad individually before.
Okay. Now, before this monumental merger proposal landed, Norfolk Southern was already on its own journey, right? Specifically trying to improve its own efficiency. Let's talk about precision scheduled railroading, PSR. Sounds very technical, but it seems absolutely central to their standalone story. What exactly is PSR?
PSR is, at its core, an operating philosophy. It's all focused on moving assets, locomotives, railcars, crews, continuously and efficiently.
How does it do that?
Think of it as a highly disciplined, almost military-like approach to running a railroad. Its core tenets are things like minimizing car dwell time, how long cars sit idle in terminals.
Okay, keep them moving.
Keep them moving. Increasing train velocity and also train length, running fewer, longer trains. And rigidly adhering to a fixed operating plan, a tight schedule.
So more discipline, less variability.
Exactly. All of these elements are designed to drastically reduce the resources needed, fewer locomotives, fewer rail cars, fewer crews to move a given amount of freight.
And the financial goal?
The ultimate financial goal of PSR, and what every railroad implementing it is shooting for, is a sustained reduction in the operating ratio, or OR.
The OR, right. Remind us what that is.
That's a key industry metric. It measures operating expenses as a percentage of revenue. So the lower the OR, the more profitable and efficient the operation is deemed to be.
Yay, got it. Lower OR equals better efficiency, better profits. So it sounds good on paper, but the implementation of PSR at Norfolk Southern, it certainly faced its share of turbulence, didn't it? What were the main hurdles they hit?
It definitely wasn't a smooth ride for them, no. Norfolk Southern was actually a relatively late adopter of PSR compared to many of its peers like CSX or the Canadian Rails.
When did they start?
They formally launched their version called TOP21 back in 2019. And they had an ambitious goal, achieving a 60% ORR by 2021.
Did they get there?
No. While they did make some initial progress, the strategy got significantly disrupted, first by the unforeseen challenges of the COVID-19 pandemic, which threw everything into chaos.
Right. Supply chains went haywire.
Exactly. But then it was disrupted even more profoundly by the February 2023 East Palestine incident.
Ah, okay. How did that derail PSR?
Well, that derailment forced an immediate and, frankly, necessary pivot in priorities for management. They had to shift focus sharply towards enhancing safety and service resilience across the entire network,
which
ironically involved adding resources back in, hiring more personnel, maybe running shorter trains for a while, increasing inspections, actions that actually run counter to a pure, aggressive, cost-cutting PSR approach.
So, safety versus efficiency. A tough balancing act.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It created a real tension there.
Yeah.
Prioritizing safety, even if it meant pumping the brakes a bit on pure efficiency gains, was a necessary step, but it slowed down the PSR momentum.
That makes sense. But that period of retrenchment, the safety focus, the slower PSR progress, that must have caught the attention of some watchful eyes, particularly investors.
It did indeed, and quite dramatically. That period contributed directly to an activist investor campaign kicking off in early 2024.
An activist campaign aimed at NSC.
Yes, led by Ancora Holdings.
Yeah.
This campaign ultimately culminated in a settlement, changes to the board, and crucially the appointment of a new chief operating officer, John Orr.
John Orr. What's his background?
Orr is an executive with a very strong track record, specifically in implementing PSR successfully at other Class I railroads. He was instrumental in the turnaround of CPKC's Mexico operations, for example.
So a known PSR expert.
Exactly. And he immediately began executing what's being called an accelerated PSR 2.0 strategy at NSC. It signaled a renewed, much more aggressive commitment to driving efficiency.
So a renewed push. What does this PSR 2.0 actually look like on the ground? Can you give us some tangible examples of what Orr started doing?
It's characterized by an intense focus on core operational discipline, getting back to the absolute fundamentals of efficient railroading.
Like what?
For example, a key initiative has been significantly improving asset utilization, especially the productivity of their locomotive fleet. How well are they using their engines?
How did they improve that?
Well, one visible sign was their decision to place over 500 locomotives into storage during 2024.
Taking engines offline, how does that help?
It frees up capital, reduces maintenance costs, and forces the network to run more efficiently with the remaining fleet. They also introduced new efficiency metrics. One key one measures how much freight they're moving per unit of locomotive power, gross ton miles, or available horsepower.
And did that improve?
Significantly. That metric jumped from a low of about 94 in mid-2023 to 129 by the fourth quarter of 2024. That signals a real improvement in how efficiently they were using their core assets.
What else?
They also set aggressive near-term targets to improve network fluidity, how smoothly things run. Things like reducing terminal dwell time in major yards by 30%.
30% reduction in cars sitting around.
Right. Cutting crew overtime by 20%. Increasing on-time performance by 10%. Really tangible operational goals.
And the ultimate goal of all this?
The ultimate goal, what drives all of this, is closing that profitability gap with their peers. Specifically, achieving a sub-60% operating ratio within 3 to 4 years. That would be a huge improvement from where they were.
Did all this renewed effort under Orr actually start to pay off? Did they see tangible improvements in their numbers before the UP offer came along?
They absolutely did. The renewed focus on PSR translated pretty quickly into demonstrable improvements in key performance metrics.
Such as?
Well, in the fourth quarter of 2024, Norfolk Southern was notably the only Class I railroad to achieve year-over-year improvements in both average train speed and terminal dwell time. Those are two crucial indicators of network fluidity.
So they were the only ones getting better on those fronts.
At that specific time, yes. For the full year 2024, the company's adjusted operating ratio improved by 160 basis points, down to 65.8%. Still high, but improving.
And that momentum continued.
It did. It continued strongly into 2025. Their second quarter adjusted OR improved a further 170 basis points year over year, down to 63.4%. They were clearly moving in the right direction.
It's really fascinating how this progress, this proof that the turnaround was maybe taking hold, forms such a critical backdrop to the Union Pacific offer. It's almost like UP saw the writing on the wall.
I think that's a very plausible interpretation.
Saw this turnaround accelerating and decided they needed to move before the value was fully realized.
Indeed. The timing is suggestive. The bid was launched just as the company's new leadership, under Orr, was beginning to demonstrate its ability to execute a credible, accelerated efficiency plan.
Right.
This timing strongly suggests that Union Pacific was motivated, at least in part, to acquire NSC before the full financial benefits of this accelerated PSR were realized in NSC's results and then reflected in a higher standalone market valuation.
So UP swoops in to capture that turnaround value for themselves?
Essentially, yes. The acquisition allows UP to potentially capture the value of NSC's ongoing turnaround for itself, in addition to all the strategic synergies of the combination they're touting. Mm. It makes the timing look very strategic from UP's perspective.
So, just as Norfolk Southern was finally gaining some real momentum with its operational improvements, it's PSR 2.0. A single devastating event plunged the company into its deepest crisis, fundamentally altering its course. We're talking, of course, about the East Palestine derailment.
Yes.
An incident that reverberated far, far beyond the tracks, didn't it? What exactly happened there, and what did the official investigation ultimately reveal?
The derailment of that Norfolk Southern train in East Palestine, Ohio, on February 3rd, 2023. Hmm. It was absolutely a watershed event, a moment of profound crisis for the company, for the community, for the entire industry, really.
What were the specifics?
It involved 38 rail cars derailing, 11 of which were carrying hazardous materials, most notably vinyl chloride. A large fire ensued.
And then came the vent and burn.
Yes, critically, 3 days later, responders made the highly controversial decision to conduct a controlled vent and burn of 5 tank cars containing that vinyl chloride monomer. It released a large, dark plume of smoke over the area, raising huge concerns.
What did the NTSB find was the cause?
In its final report, the National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, identified the probable cause as the catastrophic failure of an overheated wheel bearing on the 23rd rail car. Apparently, it had been emitting heat warnings from trackside detectors for miles before the derailment.
So, a mechanical failure. But the NTSB was quite critical of Norfolk Southern beyond just the bearing failure, right?
Yeah.
Especially regarding the vent and burn.
Very much so. The NTSB's investigation was highly critical of several parties involved, including NSC itself. A key finding was that the decision to conduct that vent and burn was, in the NTSB's assessment, unnecessary.
Unnecessary. God.
They concluded it was based on incomplete and misleading information provided by NSC and its contractors. These contractors apparently inaccurately suggested that the tank cars were at imminent risk of a catastrophic explosion, leading to the vent and burn decision.
Wow. What else did the NTSB criticize?
They also identified significant shortcomings in NSC's system of wayside hot bearing detectors, the very system designed to catch problems like this, and the procedures for responding to warnings. They felt the system ultimately failed to provide the train crew with adequate warning to stop the train before the bearing completely failed.
This sounds like an immense financial burden resulted from all this. What were the quantifiable impacts? What is the actual price tag on this disaster for NSC?
The financial consequences have been, well, immense, and they continue to accrue even now. The financial burden alone quickly surpassed $1.1 billion by early 2024, and it's still rising. This wasn't just a cost, it was a devastating strategic blow.
How did they account for it?
In its full year 2023 financial results, Norfolk Southern recognized a total charge of $1.1 billion specifically related to the incident.
What did that cover?
It breaks down into several categories.
Yeah.
First, environmental remediation costs. That includes the direct costs of site cleanup, extensive soil and water testing, long-term environmental monitoring. That totaled $836 million as of early 2024.
Okay, almost a billion just for cleanup. What else?
Then there are community assistance payments and legal fees, covering things like payments for resident relocation, setting up community investment funds, and all the associated legal expenses. That amounted to another $381 million as of early 2024.
So we're already way over a billion. Were there any major settlements on top of those costs?
Yes, very significant ones followed. Norfolk Southern reached an agreement in principle. It's important to note, it's still pending final court approval to pay $600 million to resolve a class action lawsuit filed on behalf of residents and businesses in the affected area.
$600 million for the class action. Any government settlements?
Yes. Additionally, the company reached a settlement with the U.S. government valued at over $310 million.
What did that entail?
That government settlement includes a $15 million civil penalty under the Clean Water Act, an estimated $235 million to cover all past and future cleanup costs incurred by the government, and $25 million dedicated to funding a 20-year community health program for the affected community.
Good grief. That's a staggering total when you add it all up. How much did insurance even cover for NSC? Was there any relief there?
Unfortunately, very little in comparison to the total cost. NSC reported recovering only $101 million from insurance as of early 2024. And crucially, they stated they have already exhausted their available liability insurance coverage for the event.
So they're basically on the hook for the rest.
Pretty much. When you synthesize all these publicly disclosed figures and accounting charges, the net financial impact to date is well over $1.6 billion. And again, that figure is still expected to increase as legal proceedings continue and long-term monitoring costs are finalized over decades.
That kind of financial hit, it must have put immense pressure on the company.
Absolutely. It effectively wiped out years of hard-won operational improvements and created an immense pressure cooker environment for Norfolk Southern's management and board. You could argue it significantly paved the way for considering drastic action, like a merger.
Beyond just the money, how did Norfolk Southern respond operationally to try and prevent this again? And what about the regulatory fallout? It seems like this would have drawn a huge spotlight from Washington.
Indeed it did. In the immediate wake of the incident, Norfolk Southern launched a 6-point safety plan.
What was in it?
It included things like enhancing its network of those hot bearing detectors, investing in new digital inspection portals that use machine vision technology to scan rail cars, and initiatives aimed at strengthening its internal safety culture and training programs.
Did it work? Did safety improve?
The company reported that these efforts contributed to a significant 42% reduction in its mainline accident rate in 2023 compared to the previous year. They claimed this brought their rate down to a level among the best in the industry.
But the regulators weren't entirely convinced.
Well, the derailment triggered a massive regulatory and political response, as you'd expect. The Federal Railroad Administration, the FRA, conducted a supplemental safety audit specifically focused on NSC.
What did that find?
Interestingly, the FRA audit noted that between 2018 and 2022, the period before the derailment, NSC's accident rate per million train miles had actually risen faster than any other major railroad. So there were underlying trends.
And politically.
The incident spurred the introduction of the Bipartisan Railway Safety Act in Congress. It aimed to mandate stricter safety standards for trains carrying hazardous materials, increase fines for violations, things like that. Though it's worth noting that legislation has so far stalled.
So the long-term consequence?
The long-term consequence for NSC and probably for the industry as a whole is almost certainly going to be more stringent and sustained regulatory oversight. The spotlight isn't going away quickly.
When you think about East Palestine, it's not just a statistic or a financial charge. It's a profound human story, a community impact. What do these kinds of incidents teach us about the very real, often overlooked societal risks inherent in these massive industrial operations?
It absolutely highlighted the immense responsibility these Class I railroads carry It's not just about shareholders. It's about the communities their tracks run through every single day.
Right.
These events serve as stark, tragic reminders that operational efficiency simply cannot come at the expense of safety, and that the public interest the STB talks about is a tangible, powerful force with real consequences.
And how much did this crisis, the financial hit, the reputational damage, the intense regulatory pressure, how much did that ultimately push the company towards considering a big transformative change like this merger with UP?
You have to assume it played a significant role. For Norfolk Southern, East Palestine wasn't just a financial and reputational catastrophe. It forced a fundamental strategic reset.
Yeah.
It also made the company, its board, its management, potentially far more receptive to a transformative proposal like the one from Union Pacific than they might have been otherwise. The pressure from all sides, financial, regulatory, political, public, became undeniable.
And that brings us right to the monumental event that has now fundamentally reshaped Norfolk Southern's future, Union Pacific's transformative acquisition proposal. This sounds like a true landmark moment in the industry, potentially ending decades of market stability.
It is, without a doubt. The announcement on July 29th, 2025, of a definitive agreement for Union Pacific to acquire Norfolk Southern represents a landmark event. Full stop.
Mm-hmm.
In the history of the North American railroad industry.
Why so significant?
This transaction, if it actually goes through regulatory scrutiny, would end decades of relative stability in the Class I railroad map. And significantly, as we discussed, it would create the first truly transcontinental railroad based entirely within the United States. That would fundamentally reshape the competitive landscape for freight transportation across the entire continent.
That's a huge claim. America's first transcontinental railroad. How is this deal actually structured? And what's the price tag? What are the terms?
The merger agreement outlines a comprehensive cash and stock transaction. Here's how it works. For each share of Norfolk Southern common stock, shareholders are set to receive exactly one full share of Union Pacific common stock, plus $88.82 in cash.
Okay, a mix of stock and cash. What was the implied value?
Based on Union Pacific's stock price around the time the deal was struck, specifically its unaffected price on July 16, 2025, that consideration implied a total value of $320 per NSC share.
$320. How did that compare to where NSC was trading?
It represented a substantial 25% premium to NSC's 30-day volume-weighted average price leading up to that date, so a significant premium.
And the total enterprise value?
The deal values Norfolk Southern at a total enterprise value of approximately $85 billion. That leads to a resulting combined entity that would be valued at well over $250 billion, a true behemoth.
What happens to NSC shareholders?
Importantly, upon completion, the existing Norfolk Southern shareholders are projected to own approximately 27% of the combined company on a fully diluted basis. So they get to participate in any potential upside from the merger, assuming it happens and delivers.
Okay, so why this merger? What's the core strategic rationale from UP and NSC's perspective beyond just getting bigger? And what kind of massive synergies are they targeting to justify this huge price tag? $85 billion is a lot.
It is. The core strategic driver is undeniably the creation of that seamless single-line rail network connecting the West Coast, the Gulf Coast, and the East Coast.
Right, the transcontinental dream.
Exactly. The companies believe this will lead to several key benefits. First, enhanced service and competition.
How so?
By eliminating the need for freight to be interchanged between separate Eastern and Western rail networks. That friction point we talk about, the combined company expects to offer significantly faster and more reliable service.
How much faster?
They're projecting a reduction of maybe 24 to 48 hours in transit times on key coast-to-coast corridors. They believe this will create a much more formidable competitor to the long-haul trucking industry and also to the recently expanded CPKC network that already spans North America.
Okay, better service. What else?
Second, it's about unlocking entirely new markets, or at least serving existing ones better. This new single-line service, they argue, will provide more efficient rail options for shippers in regions that are currently less efficiently served by rail moving between east and west. Think about the Ohio Valley, markets on both sides of the Mississippi River.
And the synergies, the cost savings and new revenue.
And critically, they're targeting massive synergies. Approximately $2.75 billion in annualized run rate synergies are expected to be achieved by the end of the third year after the deal closes.
$2.75 billion a year, where does that come from?
It's projected to come from a combination of things. New revenue opportunities created by the expanded network and improved service offering, and significant cost efficiencies from consolidating operations where they overlap, optimizing routes, reducing overhead, things like that.
And what's the value of those synergies?
This synergy target alone, if achieved, is projected by the companies to create over $30 billion in total value for shareholders over time. It's a huge part of the deal's justification.
Those are some truly immense numbers. What would the combined company look like financially on day one, assuming this happens? And what's the expected timeline? When could this actually close?
Based on their 2024 financial results, the combined entity would indeed be a financial powerhouse. The pro forma company would boast approximately $36 billion in annual revenue.
$36 billion. Okay.
Roughly $18 billion in EBITDA earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. And a highly efficient combined operating ratio projected to be around 62% relatively quickly.
So very profitable. How does it impact earnings per share for UP?
The transaction is expected to be accretive, meaning additive, to Union Pacific's adjusted earnings per share in the second full year after closing, with high single-digit accretion thereafter. So it should boost profitability relatively soon.
And the timeline, when do they hope this closes?
As for the timeline, the companies are publicly targeting a closing date by early 2027. And this is a huge but. That is, of course, entirely contingent upon receiving the necessary regulatory approvals, particularly from the STB, and also shareholder approvals from both companies.
Early 2027, that sounds like a long time. Which brings us back to the hurdles. This sounds like a blockbuster deal on paper, a true industry game changer. But you mentioned contingent upon regulatory approvals. How big are those hurdles, really? Because that early 2027 closing date feels like it has a lot of uncertainty baked in.
That's the multi-billion dollar question, isn't it? And honestly, the answer is the hurdles are enormous.
Yeah.
Potentially insurmountable. Yes. While the strategic and financial logic of the Union Pacific Norfolk Southern merger might seem compelling on paper, the transaction faces a series of formidable risks. The most significant, by far, is navigating that rigorous and highly uncertain regulatory approval process.
So the Surface Transportation Board, the STB, again, they're the ultimate gatekeepers here. Just how big of a hurdle is that, really? Given their track record you mentioned, it feels like a steep uphill battle.
It is the single greatest risk to this deal getting done, period. The successful closure of this merger is absolutely contingent upon STD approval, and the STB holds absolute authority over railroad consolidation in the U.S.
And that public interest standard again.
We need to keep reiterating their public interest standard. It's broad, it's challenging, it goes way beyond simple antitrust analysis. It forces the STB to consider impacts on shippers, labor, the environment, the whole national transportation network.
And the history.
And here's the crucial point, the history. The STB has not approved a merger between two large U.S. Class I railroads in over two decades.
Yeah.
Since 2001, when they implemented those stricter rules specifically designed to make such deals harder.
So no precedent for success under the current rules?
Effectively, no. Their skepticism was crystal clear in 2021 when they blocked that key part of CN's bid for KCS. That history demonstrates a deep-seated concern about further consolidation. It's essentially like trying to convince a very strict gatekeeper who hasn't let anyone similar through in 20 years. They're going to scrutinize every single detail, aren't they?
Absolutely. So what arguments will Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern make to try and clear that incredibly high bar? And what will the opposition likely say? Because I imagine there will be fierce resistance.
Union Pacific and Norfolk Southern will frame the merger as pro-competitive. That'll be their main argument.
Pro-competitive? How?
They'll claim it creates a much more powerful competitor to long-haul trucking, which dominates freight overall, and also a stronger competitor to the existing North American networks of CPKC and CN.
Okay.
They will emphasize the creation of new single-line service options, promising enhanced supply chain efficiency. They'll argue it benefits the broader economy through faster, more reliable service, lower emissions compared to trucks.
And the opponents, who will they be and what will they argue?
Conversely, opponents, and you can bet these will include competing railroads, most notably CSX.
Their direct competitor in the East.
Exactly. Major shipper groups representing agriculture, manufacturing, chemicals, you name it, and powerful labor unions. They will argue vehemently that the merger will substantially reduce rail-to-rail competition.
How? By going from six players to five?
Yes. They will point to the potential loss of competitive routing options at key interchange gateways, where shippers might currently have a choice between, say, UPNSC and UPCSX. They'll argue the combined entity will inevitably exert greater pricing power due to less competition, and that service could suffer ultimately harming the public interest. The debate will be intense and highly technical.
Beyond just the STB, what about broader political opposition and shipper opposition? That sounds like another formidable front that could really complicate things.
It absolutely is. You have to expect this. Given the critical role freight rail plays in the U.S. economy, touching almost every sector, this proposed merger will attract intense political scrutiny from Congress, from the Department of Justice, from various government agencies.
And the shippers themselves.
Major shipping organizations, representing those vast sectors of the economy, are highly likely to voice strong opposition. Their fundamental fear is that reducing the number of major carriers from 6 down to 5 will inevitably lead to higher rates and potentially diminish service quality, especially during what is likely to be a very complex and potentially disruptive integration period if the deal goes through.
They remember past merger disruptions.
They absolutely do. Past rail mergers have often involved periods of significant service meltdown. These shipper groups have significant lobbying power in Washington and can certainly influence public and political opinion against the deal.
Okay, so huge regulatory and political hurdles. What about the financial and integration risks, even if they somehow manage to clear those hurdles? Merging two enormous complex operations like this must come with its own massive set of internal challenges.
Oh, definitely. Even beyond the regulatory gauntlet, the transaction carries significant financial and operational risks internally. Take the cash component of the deal, for instance.
The $88 per share.
Right. That will be financed primarily with new debt issued by Union Pacific. This will result in a pro forma debt-to-EBITDA ratio for the combined company of approximately 3.3 times at closing.
Is that high?
It's manageable, but it's higher than UP's current leverage. Now, both companies have publicly committed to maintaining an investment-grade credit rating. They plan to deleverage rapidly using the combined entity's strong cash flow. UP even stated it will pause its share repurchase program upon the deal's announcement to prioritize debt reduction.
But still, more debt means more risk.
It does. This increased leverage temporarily reduces financial flexibility and certainly heightens risk, especially if there were an unexpected economic downturn shortly after the deal closes.
And the integration itself, merging these two giants.
Then there's the sheer execution and integration risk. The task of merging two of the nation's largest, oldest, and most complex transportation networks. It's absolutely monumental.
What are the specific challenges?
Integrating disparate operating systems and technologies. Negotiating and unifying the complex labor agreements across different unions and regions. Blending potentially very different corporate cultures. It presents a significant multi-year execution challenge.
And if they mess it up.
Any major service disruptions during this integration process, which history suggests are quite possible, could alienate crucial customers, drive them to trucks or other railroads, and fundamentally undermine the merger's ambitious financial and strategic goals. It's a very delicate, high-wire act with massive stakes.
And there's a serious price tag attached if it all falls apart due to regulators, isn't there? A sort of breakup fee built into the agreement.
Yes, there's a very clear signal of the perceived risk involved right in the merger agreement. It includes a hefty $2.5 billion reverse termination fee.
$2.5 billion? Who pays that?
That would be payable by Union Pacific to Norfolk Southern if the transaction fails to obtain regulatory approval from the STB.
Wow. What does that huge number tell you?
The existence of such a large fee clearly underscores the significant and acknowledged level of regulatory risk that both parties themselves have assigned to this deal. It's a very public admission of the challenge ahead and the substantial cost of failure if the regulators say no.
That brings us logically to how investors or anyone trying to understand the company's value should even think about Norfolk Southern now. How has its valuation framework shifted from being a standalone company focused on PSR to one caught in this complex merger arbitrage situation? It feels like the entire rulebook has been thrown out.
It absolutely has. You've hit the nail on the head. The proposed acquisition by Union Pacific has fundamentally reset the entire valuation framework for Norfolk Southern.
How so?
While assessing its intrinsic value as a standalone entity, what it might be worth if the deal fails, still provides a crucial baseline, a sort of floor value scenario.
Right, the break price.
Exactly, the break price. But the stock now trades primarily as a function of the merger's terms and, critically, its perceived probability of success. The entire investment analysis thus shifts away from traditional fundamental valuation, looking at standalone earnings, growth, PSR progress, to one of pure merger arbitrage.
Okay, so before this offer landed, quickly remind us, how was NSC valued on its own? What was the context there, especially with their PSR efforts finally gaining traction?
Sure. Before the merger announcement, NSC's valuation was largely a reflection of its position as a major Class I railroad that was actively undergoing that operational turnaround we discussed.
And how did it compare to peers?
Generally, in the Class I railroad peer group, valuation multiples like price to earnings or enterprise value to EBITDA are typically correlated with profitability and returns on capital. Carriers with consistently lower operating ratios and higher returns on invested capital, think Union Pacific itself or the Canadian railroads, they've historically commanded premium multiples.
And NSC.
Norfolk Southern, due to its historically higher OR and maybe less consistent execution until recently, has often traded at a slight discount to these industry leaders.
So the standalone investment case was about closing that gap.
Precisely. The standalone investment case for NSC was predicated exactly on the company successfully executing its PSR 2.0 strategy under John Orr and closing that profitability gap with its peers. Had the company achieved its target of a sub-60% operating ratio on its own, its earnings power would have increased substantially.
Which would have boosted the stock price.
Likely, yes. That likely would have led to a re-rating of its valuation multiple, bringing it closer to that of its more efficient competitors. That was the standalone bull case.
But that's all changed now. What's the new reality for its valuation in this merger context? How should we think about the $320 offer price?
In the current context, that $320 per share implied offer price from Union Pacific now serves as the primary valuation anchor for Norfolk Southern stock. That's the number everyone's focused on.
And the $85 billion total value, is that fair? High, low.
That $85 billion enterprise value represents what analysts would call a full valuation. It clearly reflects both a significant control premium paid by UP to get the deal done and also incorporates the massive $2.75 billion in synergies Union Pacific expects to realize.
Can we put a multiple on that?
Sure. Based on NSC's pro forma 2024 EBITDA of around $5.5 billion, the acquisition multiple is roughly 15.5x EBITDA.
And how does 15.5x compare?
That's definitely a premium multiple compared to where Class I railroads typically trade on their own, even the best ones. It really underscores the immense strategic importance UP places on this acquisition and the value they expect to unlock.
Okay, so the offer price is the anchor. But NSC stock isn't trading at $320, is it? There's usually a gap. What's this arbitrage spread we hear about, and what does that gap tell us about the market's confidence?
Right. You almost never see the target stock trade exactly at the offer price before the deal closes. Think of the merger arbitrage spread as the difference, the discount, between Norfolk Southern's current market price and that $320 implied offer value.
And that discount isn't just free money.
Definitely not. This spread is not an indicator of undervaluation in the traditional sense. Rather, it is the market's price, the market's compensation, for the very real risks associated with the deal actually closing.
What determines the size of that spread?
The size of that gap, that spread, is really a function of three primary variables. First, and most importantly, the market's collective assessment of the probability of completion mainly, the likelihood that the STB will approve the transaction. A wider gap, a bigger discount, signals the market sees a lower chance of success.
Okay, probability. What else?
Second, it accounts for the time value of money. We know the deal isn't expected to close until early 2027, maybe later. That's a long time to tie up capital. So the spread has to be wide enough to offer investors a sufficient potential annualized return to compensate them for that waiting period.
Makes sense. And the third factor?
The third factor is the downside risk. The spread also reflects the market's estimate of where NSC stock would likely trade on a standalone basis if the deal were to be blocked by regulators that break price we mentioned earlier. A larger potential drop from the current price down to that break price necessitates a wider spread today to compensate investors for taking that risk.
So boiling it down for someone trying to make sense of NSC now, the investment decision has gone from analyzing long-term earnings potential and PSR progress to something completely different.
That's exactly the shift. It's gone from analyzing long-term operational improvements and earnings growth to making a probabilistic assessment of a very complex multi-year regulatory process involving the STB, politicians, shippers, and unions.
So for you, the listener, the question really becomes, is the current arbitrage spread, that potential gain if the deal closes, worth the significant risk of regulatory denial plus the time your money is tied up?
That's precisely the core question now. Norfolk Southern's investment profile has been, as we said, irrevocably altered. What was an unfolding story of an operational turnaround at a strategic infrastructure asset has been completely superseded by this transformative high-stakes merger proposal.
So its own strengths matter less now.
The company's intrinsic qualities, its valuable Eastern U.S. network, the potential for margin improvement from PSR 2.0, they now serve primarily as components of that backstop valuation, that floor price, in the event the deal fails. The entire forward-looking investment case is almost entirely dependent on the outcome of the proposed acquisition by Union Pacific.
So the core thesis is simple.
The core thesis is now one of event-driven merger arbitrage. The potential for shareholder return is defined almost exclusively by the spread between Norfolk Southern's current market price and the implied $320 per share acquisition value. And that potential return has to be weighed very carefully against the substantial risk of regulatory denial by the STB and the opportunity cost of capital over that projected 1.5 to 2-year timeline to a potential closing. It's a bet on the deal closing.
Let's try to tie this back to some fundamental questions people might still have. For those of us trying to understand the underlying business, how sustainable were NSC's standalone margins becoming before this merger bombshell? Was that PSR 2.0 strategy really taking hold?
That's a fair question, looking back. Mm-hmm. On a standalone basis, the evidence from late 2024 and early 2025, driven by the accelerated PSR strategy under John Orr, strongly suggested that margin improvement was not only sustainable, but likely accelerating.
So they were on the right track.
It seemed so. There appeared to be a clear path toward closing that historical profitability gap with more efficient peers. Orr's track record elsewhere lent credibility to the idea that the improvements seen were likely the beginning of a larger positive trend.
But now,
as we've discussed, this question is largely academic for investors focused on the current situation. The relevant forward-looking margin profile isn't NSC standalone anymore. It's that of the combined Union Pacific Norfolk Southern entity. And that profile, if the projected $2.75 billion in annual synergies are realized, would be substantially higher, much more profitable than what either company could likely achieve alone. That combined profile is what matters most if the deal actually closes.
Okay, what about the company's exposure to secular growth versus potentially declining end markets? How does that balance look?
Norfolk Southern maintains a pretty well-balanced portfolio, which is a strength. Its extensive intermodal network, as we noted, is directly exposed to the secular growth trends of e-commerce and the ongoing optimization of global supply chains. Those trends aren't going away.
And the industrial side.
The merchandise segment is tied to the cyclical but generally enduring U.S. industrial economy. And remember, they have that leading position in the automotive sector, which is a major, relatively stable market over the long term.
And coal, the declining part.
And yes, the coal segment clearly faces that secular decline in domestic thermal coal for power plants. But it retains a valuable, cash-generating franchise in export metallurgical coal for steelmaking, which provides a significant source of cash flow and is less correlated with those domestic energy trends, offering a valuable hedge. So it's a mixed but overall robust portfolio.
This company, Norfolk Southern, has certainly faced an absolute gauntlet of challenges in recent years. East Palestine tragedy, the activist pressure, implementing PSR, and now navigating this massive merger proposal. How has management actually performed under that extraordinary, relentless pressure?
It's interesting. Management's navigation of these immense challenges has, in a somewhat paradoxical way, been a catalyst for profound change within the company.
How so?
Well, the operational and safety failures that culminated in the East Palestine derailment created a profound crisis, yes, but that crisis ultimately forced a necessary strategic reset. It pushed them towards a deep reevaluation of their priorities, especially around safety and operational resilience.
And the activist pressure.
The subsequent pressure from the activist investor, Ancora, directly led to those board changes and the appointment of the new COO, John Orr, who then implemented that more aggressive and arguably more credible operational improvement plan, PSR 2.0.
Which made them a target.
Ironically, yes. This tangible progress under Orr arguably made NSC a more attractive acquisition target in the eyes of Union Pacific because it demonstrated a clearer path to improve standalone performance and value. So the board's decision to accept Union Pacific's offer can be seen as the culmination of this entire period of intense challenge, forced change, and ultimately transformation for Norfolk Southern.
So looking forward now, what are the key catalysts? What should people watch for that could drive outperformance or underperformance for NSC's stock from here?
It's become incredibly focused now. The single overriding catalyst is the regulatory review process for the Union Pacific merger. specifically the STB's actions.
So news from the STB is key.
Absolutely. Any communication, any ruling, any public statement from the STB, or even influential comments from major shippers, politicians, or the DOJ that is perceived by the market to either increase or decrease the probability of the deal's approval, that will be the primary driver of the stock's performance relative to the deal price.
What drives underperformance?
Clear underperformance would be triggered by any definitive sign of regulatory rejection or even significant delays or onerous conditions imposed by the STB. A flat-out rejection would cause the stock to reprice sharply downwards towards its estimated standalone fundamental value, that break price.
And outperformance?
Outperformance in this context means the gradual closing of that merger arbitrage spread. That would happen as the expected closing date gets nearer and regulatory approval appears progressively more certain in the market's eyes. Any positive signal from the STB could narrow that spread.
How does NSC's risk-adjusted return profile now compare to other typical infrastructure investments, like maybe a utility or a pipeline?
It's completely different now. Its profile is no longer that of a typical infrastructure investment, which investors usually value for stable, predictable cash flows, maybe some modest, consistent growth, and often a decent dividend yield.
NSC is not that anymore.
No. Norfolk Southern now offers a binary event-driven return profile. The potential upside is largely capped near the $320 deal price, while the potential downside is a sharp drop to its standalone valuation if the deal fails. This high-risk, potentially high-reward scenario is much more akin to a special situation investment or a dedicated merger arbitrage play than it is to a traditional buy-and-hold infrastructure investment. It's a very different kind of risk profile.
Lastly, stepping back, what is the underlying long-term outlook for freight rail demand generally in NSC's key eastern U.S. markets? Is the fundamental backdrop still positive?
Yes. Fundamentally, the long-term outlook for freight demand in the eastern U.S. remains quite favorable. It's underpinned by basic factors like population and economic growth over time, the potential ongoing trend of manufacturing onshoring or nearshoring, and expected continued activity and growth at the major Atlantic and Gulf Coast ports that NSC serves so well.
And rail's competitiveness.
And rail's inherent cost and environmental advantages, especially for long-haul freight, position it well to continue capturing market share from trucking over long term, assuming they provide reliable service.
So the merger is a bet on that future.
In many ways, yes. The proposed merger itself can be seen as a powerful strategic bet by Union Pacific on this favorable long-term growth outlook. Its primary goal, remember, is to create a more efficient and competitive national network specifically designed to capture an even larger share of the total U.S. freight market from trucks. It's fundamentally a strategic move designed for the long haul, betting on the future of rail.
This has been a truly comprehensive deep dive. Norfolk Southern's story, especially right now, perfectly captures this incredible tension between deep-rooted, stable industry dynamics, the oligopoly, the moats, and the high-stakes gamble of a truly transformative, maybe even historic merger.
It really does.
It's a massive opportunity on paper creating this integrated national network, but one that faces just a formidable regulatory gauntlet, the outcome of which could reshape not just two companies, but potentially the entire logistics backbone of the country.
Absolutely. And as this deep dive shows, an investment thesis in Norfolk Southern has just fundamentally changed. It's morphed from being about a traditional industrial company executing a turnaround to being a high-stakes, event-driven play focused almost entirely on this merger's outcome. The next year and a half to 2 years will be absolutely fascinating to watch unfold.
So here's a final thought for you to mull over. If this merger actually navigates that gauntlet and goes through, creating America's first truly coast-to-coast railroad, how might that fundamentally reshape the very flow of goods across our continent? What broader implications could a more consolidated, perhaps more efficient, perhaps more powerful rail network have for manufacturing locations, for the resilience of our supply chains, and maybe even for the daily lives of consumers like you long after the deal is done and the tracks are laid?